talk. This is, although I have notes for this, it's a really, almost all my talks are, it's relatively informal. The first thing I would like to say, though, is how pleased I am to be here among these paintings, Sarah's paintings, because, of course, horsemen and painters have a long and rich tradition. In that corner of the room, we have a state-of-the-art kind of video equipment, but that's very, very recent in the history of horsemanship, which goes back some 6,000 years. And before that, it was really the painter who helped the horseman, educated the horseman, and inspired the horseman. So, and it was the horseman who gave to the painter a constant motion model with their riding. So there was this encouragement of each other's muse. And it was a very close relationship and a rich relationship. And it's really a joy to me just to look around here and see these particular paintings, especially knowing the subject where they come from the heart and soul of classical riding today in Vienna and at the Spanish Riding School in Austria. So I'm happy to be here for that reason. The talk tonight is entitled Riding as an Art Form, and it really is. I want to talk in two kind of sections, and the first section is from a sort of societal perspective, and this has to go from a slightly historical perspective, and then as an individual perspective as to the art of riding. More than a few months ago, it was actually around Bastille Day, but there was an article in a local newspaper where I live in southern Pennsylvania, and there's a town not far from where I live called Asylum. And this article, the title of it went something like, "They don't celebrate Bastille Day in Asylum." So I thought this was interesting. You know, it's a little French community, and I wonder, what is this all about? All French people now celebrate Bastille Day. Bastille Day was celebrates the fall of Bastille in 1789, and it's the overthrow of the monarchy of France by the revolutionary forces of Bonaparte. So what is it about that? What is it about Asylum that they don't go along? Well, it turns out that Asylum was founded by a royalist named Charles Ohme, who was an écurier or a master trainer at the School of Versailles. Now, Versailles has two meanings to horsemen. One, there is a physical place, Versailles, which is the stables of the French kings, and Versailles also is almost a philosophical term for horsemen, because it represents a kind of a zenith in a certain kind of equitation. the reason Ohme came to found Asylum was that being an écurier, being a royalist, and sensing the political climate was closing in on this monarchy in the late 1700s, he escaped and came to this country to build a place, a refuge, for Marie Antoinette. And it was his intention that she would be able to also escape and come to live here in the United States. It's interesting to just take note that Marie Antoinette was a descendant of the Bourbon kings. She was a descendant of the Habsburgs of Austria. And the Habsburgs of Austria were the founders of the Spanish Riding School, and this was all happening at that time. It's not necessary to know all the details, but you can sense the web of the connection among at this time in Europe of the royalty and of their connection with horses. In the end, of course, we all know that Marie Antoinette never made it to America. She never made it anywhere. I mean, a guillotine was in order. And I think Ohme may have come here and may have died here in Asylum, Pennsylvania. To me, I don't think that the newspaper reporter who wrote that article had any the slightest idea of the historical significance that Versailles means to horsemen, or especially horsemen who think of riding or dressage riding as an art form. So what kind of place was this Versailles? Well, I think before we go into that, we have to backtrack a little bit without being too tedious, because you have to know kind of where the art form of riding originates. Now, some will take it back as far as Xenophon in 400 BC or whatever. But really, most people, when they're talking about the sort of modern art form of riding, you're coming to this area of Versailles. But Versailles gets its start, really, in the 1500s, when a man named Federico Grissone found a book, a copy of Xenophon's book, The Art of Horsemanship, and read it, and then opened up his own school. Now, if you know anything, if you read about Gersone, you'll find out that I don't know what copy Gersone read of Xenophon's book, but he had a much different interpretation than Xenophon's gentle way, because Gersone was extremely brutal. But I never thought Gersone was that important, except that he found Xenophon's book and started the first school. He has an interesting relationship with a man who I think is much more important in Pignatelli. Now, both these men have schools in northern Italy. Pignatelli's school was about the same time. We're still talking in the late 1500s. And in Pignatelli's school, he had an amazing clientele. There were noblemen came from all over Europe and came to school there and then returned to their countries. Some of them are all famous names in their own right. But one of the probably the most famous was a man named Antoine Plouvenel. Plouvenel probably gets notoriety for serving at least three French kings, but also for leaving us with a masterful book. And this book is a dialogue between one of the young French kings and Plouvenel telling him about the art of riding and why riding is so important and why they should sink more money into it. It's a real sales job in one way, because he's got to sell the young king on, let's have some more riding schools, we need more money for this, you know. It's, to me, the most interesting thing about this dialogue is that it's very clear that Plouvenel is not just selling riding as getting on a horse and training animals to do tricks. Plouvenel is selling that riding is in the class of art and literature, and that is trained and it is taught to these noblemen in that same way. It's all integrated into this part. One of the, there is a famous quote in that book by Plouvenel, and he's talking to the king, and he says, "Thus your majesty can see quite clearly how useful this beautiful exercise is to the mind, since it instructs and accustoms it to perform with clarity and order all these functions amid noise, worry, agitation, and fear." Now, it's clear to me that these are, that he's talking about using the riding as a meditative or an art form. It's not just a technical skill. This is not like shooting a gun or whatever. It's using this to develop the mind and to calm the mind amid noise, agitation, and fear, and so on. After Plouvenel's service to the kings in about, it says now around 1593, he opened his own school. And in that school, not right alongside with riding, their art, literature was taught to the students in that school. There are more and more horses now being trained. There are more, it's becoming more and more popular. And the thing is escalating all the time. So that by the time of 1685, there were at least 10 riding academies around Paris and Versailles. And there were the Sun King at 5,000 horses in his stable. There were literally thousands of horses in the stables of the royalty, and also among these people who were not connected with the royalty. That area of Versailles and that area around Paris was becoming a real core for professional horsemen and trainers and educators. Now, for a moment, we have to talk about Versailles proper. That would be just the palace, let's say, of Louis XIV at that time. There were two areas, to give you an idea, for horses there. There were two main stable areas, and in the one, I think there was 600 horses or something, they think, and 400 in the other. So he had personally 1,000 horses in his own stable. He did more than just keep the horses there, but it was really a kind of a riding school in that families, good families, quote unquote, from out Europe could send their children, their sons, there were only sons, that sent them to this school and to be trained. But there also, in that school, was also all the king's pages were trained. And then there were even special elite instructors were trained. And on top of the whole mess were the official master trainers or the écuyers of the king. So that was a very prestigious position, and that, of course, was Homais' position, the founder of the town of Asylum. In the next 100 years, I think riding really thrived, and it became an integral part of every nobleman's education. And it's clear to me that throughout this time, there's the teaching of writing was never a kind of technical or skill-oriented or just a technical-oriented endeavor. It was very much an artistic endeavor, a philosophical kind of thing, and an educational thing in that realm. And that kind of points to, gives you a little feel of what is going on in this whole area of Versailles. They are training horses, but they're not just training horses. So when you talk about Versailles being the zenith of showing a certain kind of riding, it's not just that the riding at Versailles, which was at such a high level, it's that it was at an artistic level, and that the main thrust of it was that you were educating artists on horseback. And this is the tradition that we have when we talk about riding as an art form. It comes from here. It comes from this time in Versailles. I wanted to just read you this. This is a recent interview. They call it an interview with the Grand Master, and he's a man named Michel Henriquet, and he has a place in France where he trains horses. And I thought I would just listen to his own words about what he thinks of Versailles. Maybe it's interesting to read it so you know a little bit about him. In Valley, close to Paris, is situated a riding establishment of Michel Henriquet and Catherine Durand. Henriquet does not compete at all. This interview was in Dressage and CT magazine, so if anyone wanted it, they could probably get it from there. It was also reprinted in this Andalusian magazine. It's an excellent interview by this man. The interesting thing is Catherine Durand, who has been a student for a long time and has worked with him, competes on the very same horses, these Andalusian Lusitano horses, and she competed, for example, at the Grand Prix of Barcelona for France. He doesn't, has nothing to do with that, but they're paired together, which to me says that gives him a certain integrity of speaking, because he's not just some elitist. He actually produces horses that can compete if they have to, and also are artistic horses. So I think you can listen to him when he has something to say. In the enclosed school, or the outdoor rectangle, surrounded by trees and bushes, one can observe Henriquet and Catherine working their horses. The group of spectators was international, so were the pupils. On that Sunday, April 24th, a pupil was returning to Spain with his horse. Another was coming from Portugal. Also present was the Dutch champion in dressage. A Swiss girl was also due to arrive. The chief trainer at the Cadre Noir also visits the establishment, and it is possible to, then she goes on, it is possible to either reside in their home on the hillock overlooking the two schools and stables, or to be put up at a pension nearby. On that day, I was in luck to watch Henriquet ride a recently acquired Andalusian, 6 years old, who had arrived only 2 months ago. I watched this extraordinary creature do voltes, the shoulder in, haunches in, and half past. His movements were ample, his extended trot superb. It was hard to believe that this horse executed his movements so easily and calmly only a short while ago, when gently touched on his flanks, almost crashed into the wall. So frightened had he been by his experience in the bullfighting ring. According to Henriquet, he is very sensitive to the aids and has a good disposition. What more does one want? For 35 years, Henriquet has been launching Iberian horses. He was one of the first to introduce them into France. Now, there's an interview, it's a long and detailed interview, but because I want to just read what's apropos to my remarks on Versailles, it says, the interviewer says, you have just mentioned the school of Versailles, what can you say about it? Now, he backtracks a minute to answer their previous question, he said, because he's talking about one of his teachers. And he says, I must add to my previous remarks that through René Bacharach, I also acquired a certain amount of equestrian culture, that is, a knowledge of the classical works on equitation, the works of such men as Salomon de Roux, Charzenze, and Plouvenel, and of course the discovery of what was formulated in a clear and beautiful language, namely the School of Horsemanship of François Guérinier. And that is that book right there. For me, the spirit of Versailles was expressed in the works of Le Guérinier. Of course, I should add that we now know that Le Guérinier was never part of the School of Versailles, since an academy, when he's saying the School of Versailles, he's saying Versailles proper, the actual stables of the king. So he was not part of the stables of the king, that Versailles. He was part of the broader general philosophical Versailles, where he did have his own private professional stable there near that area. Since an academy and stables had been created for him precisely in the area of the former academy that existed during the reign of Louis XIII. Thus, for me, the School of Versailles is the summit of equestrian art. and it was Rene Bachrach who revealed to me what the school was most probably like. The only reason I read that to you is to show you that a man of that caliber regards that to be the summit of equestrian art. Whether you would want to debate that or not, I don't think it's important. The fact is that he is a historian, and he is an excellent horseman, and he has and that is his opinion, and I think there's great value in it. when one says that Versailles was the zenith, I don't think that you don't want to get trapped into thinking that it's necessary to know what were the exact kind of ways they rode their horses there. That isn't the point, I don't think. The point is, and that is certainly isn't the point of my lecture tonight, because my lecture is to talk about the art part of riding. And so I'm not talking about, okay, what bits did they use at Versailles? What movements did they do at Versailles? Was the, haunches in a classical movement at Versailles? That isn't the point. The point is that it was this artistic way they approached riding, and it was this broad educational kind of philosophical attack of the subject, all right? And that, I think, is also what Henri Kay is saying, that he's not necessarily wanting to be trapped by the exact exercises, but he's talking about the mentality of the riders in that age. When Homais tried to escape, all right, the monarchy was destroyed. As I said before, about that time now, there was this diffusion already in Versailles, not only of the stables proper, but of these private riding schools throughout Paris. And it was really that diffusion, that kind of sage riding, because had the monarchy fallen, as it did, and all the horses would have been destroyed or whatever, it would have been the end of this classical era, and it would be hard to imagine how this was going to be, transferred down through the generations. But luckily, people like Guernier, who were actually civilians and had professional establishment, kept it alive. And from the time of Versailles, I think that you automatically see there a real shutting down of massive schools of riding to where it leads today, where you see, individuals almost scattered. But I think that fragmentation of classical riding, or riding as an art form, began back there. When they crushed the monarchy of France and they destroyed kind of that, there was left, the Habsburgs and the Spanish riding school, but this already began to break that apart, and individuals had to take over where the monarchies left off. Now, this leads us more to the kind of the individual's role in the art of riding. Under the patronage of kings, art can flourish as it did in Versailles. I mean, artists can lead prestigious lives, they're admired and they're respected, and they get the favors of royalty. To lead an artist's life today in the society that we live in is very difficult. There isn't much, reward, and it's there certainly isn't a lot of prestige unless you're famous or, you get on hard copy or something, otherwise, nobody knows what you're doing, It's not like it used to be. Suppose any government figure in almost any society today were to say, I would like to build an opulent riding school. I mean, they would be hung, in a few weeks. It's not possible anymore to do that kind of thing. Private individuals try from time to time, but it still really doesn't seem to be possible anymore because of just the way the world is. So then how does an individual today pursue art? How does an individual create art? And how, more importantly, does an individual take art from an idea and make it into reality? Joseph Campbell, who is a mythologist and a great lecturer and a philosopher, really, the late Joseph Campbell, has some wonderful lectures, and some of them are on art and this process of how art is formed and so on. Whenever he does these things, he usually includes this anecdote about his wife, who was a very famous dancer with Martha Graham Jean Erdman, so a great artist in her own right. And he says that they were talking one day, and she said that, that the artist and the mystic, who was more interesting to Campbell, are really the same, except the artist has a craft, all right? Now, there are a lot of other statements that resonate that same kind of feeling, and one that's not as serious, but meaning almost funny, but the same type of thing, is it's an old saying that says that the poet and the schizophrenic swim out into the same ocean, only the poet knows how to come back. And so, what's the significance of these kind of statements? I think what they point to is this business of abandonment to the creative process, and yet a kind of discipline to save you from that same creative process. Now, it's very clear, if you know anything about the history of art or whatever, that many artists don't make it because they fall, you know, prey to the forces of creativity, and they have no way to control them, and they end up, it costs them their life. But there is something to be said for learning to balance the process. Interestingly enough, today, there is a lot of research going on which may someday yield a physiological explanation for this process. Whether it does or whether it doesn't, it really doesn't matter to me, because it's a beautiful way to explore this whole idea of the creativity versus the discipline. And it has to do with the research into the human brain, and that the human brain has two hemispheres and that they are not exactly alike. A lot of this is popular science, but in any case, to short circuit the whole procedure a little bit, the general gist of a lot of the theory is that the left side of the brain, of the human's brain, is the logical analytical side and is the linguistic center, and the right hemisphere is the abstract, the holistic part, the dreaming part, the unconscious part, all right? And that there is a division between the two, and there are many experiments. I wanted to read you one little anecdote from a book that I think is a little better than just the popular is sort of notions of this, a little more scientific. But I think this little story can really reveal this whole process of the left brain, right brain, the unconscious creativity part versus the discipline part. And it's a little story about a famous scientist. Arthur Koestler, a well-known writer, argued that the creative act usually occurs through other than conscious analytical intention. In his book, The Act of Creation, Koestler mentions the idea of incubation periods, putting a problem aside for a time in the hope of coming up with an insight later. He also suggested that the unconscious does a great deal of matchmaking or forming of analogies. Several famous scientists have told how they found a solution to a problem during a dream. Otto Loewi, who won the 1936 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for showing that nerve impulses are transmitted by means of chemical agents, described how the critical experiment came to him in a near-sleep state. He had come up with the idea of a chemical transmission 17 years earlier, but had put it, quote, aside, unquote, for lack of a way to test it. 15 years later, he performed experiments unrelated to this old idea, for which he had designed a technique to detect fluid secreted by a frog's heart. One night, 2 years later, now he's speaking, I awoke. I turned on a light, jotted down a few notes on a tiny slip of thin paper, and then I fell asleep again. It occurred to me at 6 o'clock in the morning that during the night I had written down something most important, but I was unable to decipher the scrawl. The next night, at 3 o'clock, the idea returned, luckily. It was the design of an experiment to determine whether or not the hypothesis of chemical transmission that I had uttered 17 years ago was correct. I got up immediately, went to the laboratory, and performed a simple experiment on a frog heart according to the nocturnal design. Back to the text. Loewi isolated two frog hearts, the first with its nerves intact, the second without. He stimulated the vagus nerve of the first heart. The vagus nerve has an inhibitory effect on the heart, so its beat slowed down. He immediately removed some of the salt solution in which the heart was bathed and applied it to the second heart. It slowed down. By going a few steps further, Loewi unequivocally proved that nerves influence the heart and more other tissue by releasing specific chemical substances from their terminals. A careful review of the chain of events leading to Loewi's experiment dispels any notion that it was an accidental or purely intuitive discovery. The background for it had been set up by years of rigorous work.
However, the act of connecting two critical ideas apparently came while he was in an unconscious or semi-conscious state. All right? So we have, maybe someday they will be able to tell us how art works, and that one part of your brain and the unconscious comes up with an intuitive notion, and then another part of your brain has to take over to execute it. Even if this research is inconclusive, it still, as I say, is worthwhile as an analogy, because this is exactly the same kind of thing that Eastern teachers have been talking about for centuries. The notion of dualities and the notion of, as they say in Zen, of finding the middle path, of somehow reaching this problem of the struggle of two opposites, all right? Creativity and discipline have to go hand in hand. Everybody has great intuitive ideas, all right, but it takes training and so forth to be able to apply this idea or to bring it to fruition and still carry some emotion through it. And this, of course, I think is the job of the artist. If there are, then, these kind of physiological requirements, there are also, then, some spiritual requirements for the formation of art, to make something art form. Campbell likes to quote, when he talks about this part, he likes to quote James Joyce, who was a brilliant writer and one of the foremost artists in recent times. And Joyce talks about art being proper or improper. And proper art, generally, is art that serves art. Improper art serves other purposes. And Joyce goes on to call it could even be pornographic. And not pornographic in the sense that now it's all out of proportion, but pornographic in the sense it comes from the Greek word pornographos, which means the writing of harlots, but it's also akin to the Greek word pernani, which is to sell. So what Joyce is saying, that art is art that is used to do something else. Now, when you're saying, so is a commercial artist or is it improper art for an artist to sell art? No, that's not what you're saying. It's when an artist uses or someone takes the art and uses then that art to sell refrigerators, then it becomes improper in use of art. All right? So there is a careful distinction in the way Joyce and Campbell talk about proper and improper art. But the gauge of Joyce's idea of proper and improper art, I think, also is applicable to equestrian art, because writing should also serve writing. If writing serves the writer's ego, if it serves commercial things, if it even serves national pride, all right, it moves away from the realm of art. And it certainly would move away from the realm of the art and the exploration at Versailles. In the new book that I wrote, Exploring Dressage Technique, there's a chapter in it, and I talk about riding as a meditation. I could have just as well entitled this chapter, Riding as an Art Form. Because what this chapter is mainly about is it's my struggle over a long period of time and my explorations to search out a classical line of riding. And, you know, I kept looking, was there a certain kind of teaching? Was there a certain school that were, you know, was there this purest classical riding? What people taught this school? And in the end of this searching, I couldn't find a pure technical line. I found that the exercises, you know, whether one exercise became deemed classical or not had a lot more to do with the charismatic personality of the person who was executing that exercise, whether really it was something anatomical or not. So it was very difficult for me to find a pure technical line of classical riding. I found, though, that there was a line, and the line was more metaphysical. Interestingly enough, when I think about it now, almost after I wrote that book, the litmus test almost for whether riding is classical is whether riding is artistic. You can almost make the two things inseparable. If something is artistic, you can almost always right away sit around and say that it's classical. And it is, if it is really classical, it's generally artistic. So let me clarify that. For me, the more I looked at it, I saw of all the schools of riding, excuse me a second, you could break it down into two schools. In one part, you had a mundane and a technical school, and in there you could shovel grisone, And even Newcastle, who was a brilliant technician, but still in my mind a technician and never really an artist, someone who wrote books and told you how to train horses and make horses do things better and the specific tricks. And the other people who go into the other school, this is the art camp or the artist school or the meditators, and then you get, you know, Xenophon, and Xenophon writes his book, and a man named Morris, an Englishman who translated books of Xenophon, says that you get the impression of translating Xenophon's book that this is the general, and he was a general, of talking to his sons and giving him advice. I mean, Xenophon's, one of the quotes in Xenophon's books is that anything forced can never be beautiful. That is not the statement of a technician, you know. That's art talk, you know. So you have to put Xenophon in the class, Xenophon is in the classical camp or Xenophon's in the art camp. I mean, I don't know what else you can do with it. Pluvinel is in his pleadings with the king. I read you that quote. You know, he says to the king, look, you know, you need this in your kingdom because this is good for the minds of your noblemen. These guys are going out and they're senselessly killing each other in duels. They need to be educated and trained, you know, and then to become, you know, gentlemen and classicists. And this is a very good discipline, you know. And again, so the Pluvinel has to be in that camp. Jocelyn wrote the part in that book with a quote of Gurnier's, and he says, you know, you can't have imitators. You have to, the horsemanship is at such a low level in my days because people imitate. They don't understand the true principles. You've got to understand the true principles, you know. Gurnier is an artist. He's interested in the art. He's interested in people's meditations on using art to, you know, to go further philosophically. He's not interested in that just you execute the shoulder in a precise way, you know. So, for me, you have these two divisions, this mundane school of riding and this more artistic school of riding. And it is similar to Joyce's requirements of art, whether it's proper art or improper art, whether it serves art or whether it serves, you know, some technical pursuit. To me, art implies a personal, unanalyzable creative power, whereas skill stresses a technical proficiency. And to me, if you want to see the difference, when you read Newcastle's book, I read Newcastle's book, and it staggers me that how brilliant he was technically. And yet, I mean, everyone's had the experience. You watch some little kid get on a, you know, piano and whip through a technically perfect piece, you know, and there's not a mistake in it, but the child hasn't got the experience yet to emote emotion. And even if you know nothing about music, you sit there feeling kind of flat. And then you see some old person come up there, you know, a Nadia Boulanger, you know, or somebody, and might have crippled fingers, and gets down to the piano and misses notes, and you're weeping in a few minutes, you know. So it isn't technical proficiency that inspires people. It's something else that makes work inspirational. And that, of course, that's what art is all about. When writing is an art, it's important then to realize that when you ride a circle, the circle is not the art. How you ride the circle is the art. It's the same as the saying that Sarah's paintbrush or pencil is the art. That is nothing. That is not the art. It is when she picks up that thing and turns that thing or makes something artistic out of it. If you only notice the geometry in riding, the size and the track of the circle, the technical requirements of the shoulder in, you can begin to miss the whole layer that goes on top of that geometry. And then all you'll begin to see is sort of this tracks in the dirt, and nothing of the music or the art that goes on top of the tracks in the dirt. When a great artist rides, I think you're not talking necessarily about the level of their skill, which could be measured, you know, in the tracking, but you're enthralled with what is going on above the tracking, and in fact you're willing to forgive all kinds of mistakes in the tracking, you know, because you're inspired by what is going on above the ground, you know. I think it's fairly easy to see that mood and emotion and aesthetic can be emoted, you know, through a work of art and also through the art of riding. Riding has to serve more than the mundane. If it doesn't serve more than the mundane, it gets in a very dangerous place of becoming very uninspirational. And then people become very disinterested, and it can very easily become, you know, extinct. Skill will not inspire people. My father was a tool and die maker, and I remember as a kid that he would bring home these tools, pieces of steel, cut, you know, within thousandths of an inch, beautiful curves and circles cut in steel. To this day, you can't do carpentry work with my father, because you do carpentry work, you know, a sixteenth of an inch to a carpenter is square. My father, a sixteenth of an inch, is like the Grand Canyon. He looks across the room, and it's a hole in the wall, you know, because all his life he worked with, you know, thousandths of an inch, you know. But even he would admit that the pieces of steel, as beautiful as they are in one sense to look at them, it is not art. You know, it is a tool, and he would tell you that. It is a tool. It can't really inspire you other than on a technical plane, you know. The pieces of steel don't emote anything that these sort of, you know, drawings can emote. Not that steel could not emote, because obviously sculptures can use that medium and emote. But those very technical pieces of steel don't do that. And if your writing becomes that tool and die cut, it has the danger of becoming just that, very tool-like and very uninspirational. And the danger is that it will become, people will be turned off by it. Writing can train the body and the mind, as Pluvinel said. It also involves another species, so that when you are doing your explorations and you are involved with another species, the answers to the questions that you will begin to explore are very profound. You find out when you explore in writing the human being's connection with other species. The relationship to the world then becomes revealed in your own, the human's relationship to the horse. It's a microcosm. But today I think that we are really in a very dangerous place with dressage, because dressage is becoming defined more and more by the geometry and not by the art. If people don't understand, you know, some of the history, and they don't have some appreciation of Versailles and of the riding without geometry, of the riding as an art form, all right, as riding, you know, in an aesthetic plane, and not riding based on the precision of the figures in the ground, to me, it will die. This has to change, and it has to change soon, I think. So where can you look today in the world to find artists? I can tell you where you're not going to find them, first off. And you're not going to find them in any of the places that the primary emphasis is on the mundane, is on, you know, profit and loss, technical precision, competition. It's just not going to be there. There the emphasis is on that. It's on skill, proficiency, it's on geometry. And you see, you can observe these lessons in this teaching, and that's what you'll see. It's nothing more than that. Geometry. There's very little talk about aesthetics or, you know, what goes on above the circles. Since Versailles, since that diffusion of the monarchy, I think art has been in the hands of individual artists, and it has diffused all over the world. And so there isn't any place anymore, other than maybe a place like the Spanish Writing School where you can go some more. But even there are only individuals within those places that are artistic, because some of the people in those places are not artists at all, are also very geometric. So you have art in the realm now of individuals throughout the world. So my last comments would be on the subject was that for my life, one of the most interesting things so far in my life has been the pursuit of those artists, and to find where those artists are around the world, and to see how they work, and to watch them work. And the only thing that I would say to you, in fact, instead of giving you, you know, directions to Van Eyndorf and directions to the Spanish Writing School or Samor or Henri Case, these are all places, but it would be for you all or anyone to find out for yourself. Because half of the fun of the whole thing is going to be in the process of exploring. Because when you get there, there may be nothing at the other end of the rainbow. But in the process, I think you will begin to uncover your own artistic bent. And in that exploration and that flowering, you help all the other artists in the world, and that is the course of action I recommend. To, you know, watch the geometry, but search out the other artists in the world and support them only with, if nothing else, with your support. That's all I have to say tonight. Thank you. Yeah.